They are one of the largest recipients of NIH funding. Their scientists played a substantial role in developing more than half the cancer drugs approved by the FDA in the last 5 years. Dana-Farber Cancer Institute has been making one advanced cancer discovery after another for over 75 years. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Lifestyles of the rich and delinquent.
Wealthy Americans default at a high rate.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Stacey Vanek Smith. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Friday, July 9th. The well-heeled are walking away from their mortgages.
China says hello again to Google, and Facebook says goodbye to little pictures of diamond rings. Don't worry, we're going to explain. But first,
if you're rich, you may be more likely to dump an expensive property that you can't afford. That's according to today's New York Times. Strategic defaults may be more common among the upper class. Here to talk about this with us is our own Nancy Marshall-Genzer. She joins us from Washington, D.C. Hi, Nancy.
Good morning, Stacey.
So, Nancy, where's this data coming from?
Well, the New York Times sorted through a bunch of housing data from CoreLogic. CoreLogic is a firm that analyzes real estate. And here's the conclusion. More than one in seven homeowners with loans over $1 million is seriously delinquent. And that means they've missed three payments in a row. That compares with only about 1 in 12 homeowners who owe less than $1 million. Basically, that's the rest of us.
Do we have any idea why wealthy Americans are defaulting more than the rest of us?
Well, some of these delinquent mortgages are for investment homes that the borrower doesn't actually live in. Maybe they rent out the house or use it as a vacation home. It's, of course, a lot easier to walk away if you're not losing the roof over your head. And I talked about this with Greg McBride, and he's a senior financial analyst at Bankrate.com.
A lot of these properties were purchased with little or no money down. Borrower didn't have any skin in the game. When the price drops 30, 40, 50%, they're more inclined than ever to walk away.
Nancy, is there anything the government can do to stop them?
No, there's not a lot the government can do, unfortunately. In fact, the Times report says the rich are actually less susceptible to tactics used by the government and banks to shame them into paying their mortgages.
Nancy Marshall-Genzer in Washington. Thank you, Nancy.
You're welcome.
The markets have had a very good week. At the same time, we've gotten some mixed news about retail sales, jobs, and other things. Here to help us figure everything out is Chris Lowe, chief economist with FTN Financial in New York. He joins us live, as he does most Fridays. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning.
Chris, the markets have had a great week. Why are they up so much?
Well, that's right. A 5% rally this week. It's in 3 days, no less. It's odd. We had almost no data this week, and actually that might be part of the thing. We've seen weaker than expected numbers in May and June. And yeah, exactly. But, you know, I think the other thing is we've been obsessed with this idea of a double-dip recession. And now with earnings season coming, people are starting to read what the analysts have to say. And it boils down to this. Slowdown, yes. Recession, no. So profits are still there. Earnings are still there.
Why do we say no recession? I ask because yesterday the International Monetary Fund came out saying that growth this year was going to be stronger than expected. Growth next year was going to slow down.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that's happening right now is we're transitioning from what economists call the recovery to an expansion. Now, what that means is that you've got the engine of growth that comes from things like consumer spending and business orders. On top of that, we've also had inventory restocking, which gives you, well, it's like a turbo on top of growth. But it's temporary. And now that inventories are getting close to where retailers want them to be, that inventory restocking slows, and you always have a slowdown about a year into a recovery. We're getting to that point right now where inventories are contributing less, but you still have the underlying growth in spending and orders.
So, Chris, the markets have been up. What about the economy? How is it doing?
Well, it's slowing down, but it's not slowing dramatically. And I think a good example, we just recently had some ISM manufacturing numbers went from 65 to 60. To put that into perspective, That's from a level consistent with 4 to 4.5% GDP growth. We've fallen back to a level consistent with 3.5 to 4. Again, it's slower, but it's not bad.
Our Friday man, Chris Lowe with FTN Financial in New York. Have a great weekend, Chris.
You too, Stacey.
On the congressional agenda after its recess, financial regulatory reform. The push for more regulation, of course, not new, with crises cropping up in all sorts of ways. Former Labor Secretary Robert Reich is here to give us his thoughts on what to expect. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, Steve.
For decades, we've heard about deregulation, but with excesses on Wall Street, and then we've had this, you know, the mining disaster and the worst oil spill in history in the Gulf of Mexico. I mean, are we heading for a new era of regulation?
Well, not exactly. Deregulation, starting in the 1970s, targeted government monopolies, airlines, trucking, utilities. Its goal was more competition and lower prices for consumers. Basically, it succeeded. Deregulation was never intended to create more health, safety, or environmental risk, or allow Wall Street to go haywire.
But is more regulation the answer, Bob? I mean, the SEC already had the power to prevent many Wall Street abuses. Same with the Minerals Management Service and BP.
Well, it's not the entire answer. The SEC's main problem was it didn't have the staff it needed to enforce the laws. At the Minerals Management Service, it was a cozy relationship with the oil industry. And even when laws are fully enforced, penalties may be so low that getting caught is just a cost of doing business. That's what happened at the Mine Safety Administration. It repeatedly cited Massey Energy before that terrible accident.
So is Congress and the White House gonna fix this?
Well, I'm skeptical. These aspects of regulation are invisible to the public. After a new law is passed, business lobbyists inevitably try to defang it by getting Congress to keep penalties low and cut the budgets of enforcement agencies. The problem is none of this becomes evident until there's a disaster.
So what's the answer then? What do we do?
One proposal, Steve, is to create a kind of super regulator in the White House or rely on the U.S. Inspector General to make sure all regulations are fully enforced. Another is to strengthen whistleblower laws so insiders can easily alert authorities when they're not being enforced. And still others want to rely more on civil litigation, you know, liability suits to police business. I expect all of these are going to be in the mix in the future.
A lot of ideas. Former Labor Secretary Robert Reich, now Professor of Public Policy at the University of California, Berkeley. Bob, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Friday, July 9th. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith. For the latest look at the markets, go to the numbers at marketplace.org. We're going to get a take on the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics around the world, and how it affects the United States. A federal appeals court denied the Obama administration's request to extend a six-month moratorium on deepwater drilling. The president said extending the ban would help prevent another oil leak, but oil companies said the ban is too broad and that it would cost thousands of jobs. Meanwhile, BP has said it will pay for the oil disaster in the Gulf, and it's asking its partners for help, Anadarko Petroleum and Mitsui Oil Exploration. The companies own about one-third of the destroyed well, and BP says that means they should pay one-third of the cost. Chrissy Clark has more.
The bills look like your cell phone bill. Kind of, except the amount due is more than $270 million and 9 cents in the case of Anadarko. Matsui's tab is for another $100 million or so. The bills cover things like drilling relief wells, paying out claims for Gulf residents, and something called intangible.
They're not my clients, but I wouldn't rush to pay that check.
That's Joe Grunfest, a professor of business law at Stanford. So far, BP's partners will neither confirm nor deny whether they'll pay the bills. But Grunfest says there are two reasons why they probably won't. First, they want a court to decide whether they're liable before they pay the tab. Second, not sharing the spill-related costs is one more way to distance themselves from BP and protect the future of their industry. Grunfest says they're trying to send a message.
We should not shut down offshore drilling. Rather, we should make sure that no one drills the way BP drills because the other drillers know how to do it safely.
Payment on the bills is due early next week. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
A major European defense company has submitted a new proposal to build expensive aircraft for the U.S. Air Force. EADS makes Airbus planes, and the company's offer is just the latest in a bitter, bitter dispute over a $35 billion military contract. Marketplace's Europe correspondent Stephen Beard is with us from London with the latest. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Steve.
What does Airbus want to build?
They want to replace the 179 of the U.S. Air Force tanker aircraft that are due to be replaced. These are the ones that refuel military planes in midair. Mm-hmm. Now, Boeing won the contract originally, but then lost it after a bribery scandal. Then EADS, which is, as you say, owns Airbus, won the contract along with an American partner. But this contract was cancelled after an uproar in Congress. Now EADS has submitted a solo bid.
And why has this contract been so bitter and disputed?
There have been allegations of blatant protectionism by the U.S. Department of Defense. Here's Howard Wealdon, a veteran defense analyst with BGC Partners.
I have never seen a competition that has been so one-sided towards the in-house party. The DOD seemed to go out of its way to favor the Boeing bid.
But what about those, Stephen, who argue the military should choose a company that would create American jobs? I mean, Boeing is an American company.
Yes, and it would create more jobs in the short term, but because EADS admits it will only be building about 65% of the plane in the U.S. But the company says if it wins the deal, it'll build a new plant in Alabama, which could in time be building commercial aircraft, and that would create more U.S. jobs. The decision on this deal, by the way, is expected by November.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Stephen, thanks.
Okay, Steve.
Google says it can legally operate its search engine in China again. So, just to recap, first, Google pulled its search engine out of China. Then it reapplied for and got its internet license to stay online in China. Confused? From Shanghai, Marketplace's Scott Tong helps us make sense of it all.
Why is Google confident it'll stay? And why would China want the company to stay after all the theatrics? Some speculate regulators think Google's good for China. The company brings good jobs and know-how. Shanghai attorney Greg Pilarowski.
They do have research and development facilities here. That is something that China has always been very interested in encouraging from foreign technology companies.
This week, Google's largely blank China site added new icons for music and shopping and an internet license number. Chinese regulators, though, say they're still processing Google's application. If they approve, internet marketing consultant Lonnie Hodge thinks young people would cheer. They've had a taste of Google, and when they use the alternative Chinese search site...
They know when they go that maybe the whole front page of a search result is going to be nonsense. It's going to be stuff that somebody paid for.
Should Google stay, China's emerging internet market is 400 million people so far. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Friday, July 9th. I'm Steve Chiotakis. For the latest look in the markets, check out the numbers at our website, marketplace.org. A San Francisco board argued late into last night about whether to ban the sale of all pets in the city limits, except fish. After 5 hours of heated testimony, the city's Commission on Animal Control and Welfare decided to delay their vote. Reporter April Demboski has more.
At first, the commission was concerned about inhumane puppy and kitten mills. But then they learned of the hamster problem.
Mommy, Mom, oh, I want a hamster, please.
That's Commission Chair Sally Stevens. She says they've heard many stories where rescue centers get saddled with animals children tire of in a matter of weeks.
We're kind of trying to interrupt that step from the impulse buy to ending up at a euthanized animal care and control.
But pet store owners say people will just buy their pets outside city limits. Jennifer Graffelman is the manager at Animal Connection in the city. She says small businesses like hers will become casualties of a largely symbolic gesture.
It's probably eventually going to put us out of business. What San Francisco wants to do is tell the nation that let's just stop animal sales in pet store retail altogether.
San Francisco has a long history of legislating in favor of minority rights. And this is one area where some local business people wish the city wouldn't take the lead. I'm April Domboski for Marketplace.
In an effort to get their balance sheets back in the black, U.S. automakers have been scrapping some underperforming models, among them the Mercury. Ford recently announced it will stop production of the 71-year-old model later this year. Contributor Hank Rosenfeld has this ode to the car that helped define him.
My mom drove a Mercury, and so did my dad and my sister and our next-door neighbor in Detroit, Mr. Krause. In fact, every day it seemed he was out in front of his house hosing down that 1963 Monterey. The first Mercury was designed by Henry Ford's son, Edsel, in 1939. Fancier than a Ford, but actually with the same body as a Ford, Mercuries were for the expanding American middle-class market. The biggest seller was the Grand Marquis, which was more like a junior Lincoln. Back then, Mercury was branded the Big M, with models like the Montego, the Montclair, the Meteor. And it was the sponsor of the Ed Sullivan Show.
Now, get set for a thrill, because we're going to put you in the driver's seat of a dream car.
Back when we dreamed big in this country, I learned to drive in my mom's Lincoln Mercury Colony Park station wagon with the fake wood paneling and the third seat in the back facing backwards. Instead of watching the world go by, you could feel yourself pulling away from it. 1978 was Mercury's biggest year. It sold nearly 600,000 cars. The heyday when Farrah Fawcett did their TV commercials. Now Farrah Fawcett's gone, and so is this.
Cougar. At the sign of the cat.
I'll never forget my Cougar, 1973, with the flip-up headlights hidden in the grill. I get into that bucket seat, and I'm gone. But sales last year for Mercury's were down to 92,299. The total market share was less than 1%. Yeah, Mercury's just too retrograde. Growing up in Detroit, you pay attention to these things. They're part of who you are. Well, who we were, anyway.
We've got some of those old Mercury ads Hank mentioned on our website, marketplace.org. And finally, Facebook is closing its virtual gift shop next month. It was the social networking site's first online store.
Right. You could buy a little picture of a birthday cake or a rose and send it to one of
right.
your friends.
The graphics cost $1 each. Facebook said the gift shop was part of a plan to become a major player in the virtual goods industry.
Apparently that didn't happen.
Yeah, I would put a little sad face on my Facebook page, but there is no way that I'm paying $1 for that. In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.